Saturday is International Women's Day. I don't know if you've all heard of International Women's Day. It's a day to commemorate the struggles of women for equal rights and within the labour movement and in society as a whole. Now, it was first celebrated, it was first marked in New York in 1908, when women took to the street to march for shorter working hours, 15,000 women. And it became a day, the 8th of March then became a day when the struggles of women were recognised internationally. And in fact, the February Revolution, although it was Russian calendars different to ours, the first Russian Revolution, which started in 1917, started on International Women's Day, again with a march of by women workers in Petrograd, as it then was. So International Women's Day goes back a long time. It was actually, the whole day was lost really as a political event for decades, and it was revived again very much in the 1960s and 70s with the rebirth of the women's liberation movement at the time. It had really disappeared in Western Europe, but really the years between 1945 and the 1970s were fairly quiet years politically throughout the world after the Second World War. And I think because there wasn't much political activity as a whole, events like International Women's Day really sort of fell by the wayside. And even in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, although officially they were committed to supporting International Women's Day, in fact it just became very depoliticised. It just became a day when wives and girlfriends were given flowers, that sort of thing. It was completely divorced from politics. So that's really what International Women's Day is actually all about. Now, where do we stand on International Women's Day? Before this meeting, just by chance actually, I was looking at the website of one of the international organisation, not IGO, NGOs called Women's Aid. They got statistics of women. They do sort of aid to the third world war zones, women who've caught up in war zones and so on. And they came out with some interesting statistics about women, that in fact of 960 million illiterates in the world, two-thirds are women. 50% of the world's population apparently do two-thirds of the work. Earn one-tenth of the world's income and own one-hundredth of the world's property. So that puts the position of women in quite an interesting, from an interesting point of view, statistic. On a more positive view, actually, from the point of view of the labour movement, women are now 50% of the workforce. And it's not just in countries like the UK and Europe, but also in the developing world now, women are increasingly part of the workforce. Having said that, though, when you look at the question of pay, then there are still, despite having an Equal Pay Act, there are quite wide discrepancies with the pay that women get. And I'm talking about the UK now. Women, apparently, according to the TUC, Trade Union Congress, are paid 17% less than men. And when it comes down to part-time workers, though, it's 35% less. And that is very significant because, of course, I haven't got the figures on this, but a large proportion of part-time workers are women. And that really brings me to the whole question of the roots of women's inequality, because I would say as a Marxist that women are part of the working class and we're actually concerned about working women. Of course, women don't get equal rights on the stock exchange, as stockbrokers and so on. And of course, you know, there is this macho culture that will keep women out. Whatever the law says, there's a culture there that keeps women out in a lot of workplaces. Of course, you've got equal pay, equal opportunities legislation. Where you have a long hours culture, then it's very easy for an employer to discriminate anyway, particularly in some of these areas, law firms and so forth. They can say that, women aren't prepared to do all the unpaid overtime. Having said that, statistics produced, I think this has been circulated by the TUC as well, show that women in their 30s are actually doing a large percentage of the number of workers now who do put in many hours of unpaid overtime. But clearly women who have child or family responsibilities can't do that. And that's why they discriminate. Of course, I'm not in favour of people doing any unpaid overtime, to be honest, as a trade unionist. I actually think that's a thoroughly bad idea, and it would be a good idea for the entire workforce if this ceased to be the case. Anyway, the roots of women's oppression lie deeper than capitalist society. As I say, we're looking at the way women workers are treated within the capitalist system that we live in. But women's oppression goes far back beyond that. So why are women unequal? And Engels wrote a book called The Evolution of Private Property and the State, and he explained that with the development of private property, women became second-class citizens because the ownership of cattle, which was the main form of private ownership, as primitive as class society evolved from a primitive communist society, the ownership of cattle was actually in the hands of men, and women were excluded from that, and that was the roots of women's oppression. But it's a book worth reading, written by Engels, of course, many, many years ago, but it's still very relevant today. Because the reason why women face double oppression, if you like, within capitalist society is not just because they're workers, but also because they have this role within the family of bringing up children, taking on the caring responsibilities and so on. And this is unpaid work, but it's work that has to be done, that society needs. But in many cases, it is unpaid work. And I said at the outset that women are now 50% of the workforce in this country, and in fact, the majority of the membership of some trade unions, like Unison. But this hasn't always been the case, that capitalism has always had a very pragmatic, I was talking about the ruling class, it has a very pragmatic attitude towards women workers. And that throughout the history of the economy over the last two centuries, that women have been excluded from the workforce. Now, I remember, I think I'm older than anyone here, and I remember growing up 30 years ago as a girl at school. And at that time, we're talking about the 1960s, most girls actually did not believe that they would be, earning their living. That they regarded that the way they would be sustained in life would be through finding a husband who would keep them full time. And it was literally possible. I mean, a lot of our parents' generation lived like that. Some women got married and they never worked again. You know, I mean, their husbands supported them. And of course, for our generation, this was considered as completely undesirable. You know, we wanted to work, wanted to have our own job, and so on. So women were completely dependent, and this happened for a very long time. And this was this caused discrimination against women within the workforce, even within the trade union movement. So. The battle for the right to work has actually been an important struggle for women, as well as for equal pay. But at times when the economy has been in recession, there have been calls for women to be returned to the home. For instance, in the 1930s, women workers were the first to be dismissed. And on the other hand, in wartime, when the Second World, First World War, when men were sent to the front to fight, women were pulled into the factories to work. Into munitions factories where they worked, under very dangerous conditions, and they didn't have protection from a trade union because they weren't organised like the skilled the men were. So they were working under the worst possible conditions. Right up until the 1950s, and you're going to be amazed at this, there was a career bar in a lot of professions that women had to leave their job in some things like civil service or teaching. If they got married, they actually had to leave. So a lot of women actually concealed their marriages. They kept the names, they didn't take their husband's name, and you could actually conceal the fact you were married and keep your job. But this was things were like this for a very long time. So that was the background to the sort of rise of the women's lib movement in the 1960s. Women had enough of staying in the home. Now, the women's lib movement was largely a middle class movement, although obviously it did attract working class women as well. But the issue of equal pay and equality was taken up by the trade union movement, and there was a strike at Ford's in 1968 for equal pay, which was one. And it was on the basis of this that the equal pay legislation was introduced. But of course, equal pay wasn't enough, because if you look at the workforce, that in fact women and men were traditionally in different jobs. Even within white-collar jobs, women are concentrated in, what's seen as the caring professions like nursing, teaching, dare I say, librarianship. Now, there has been a sea change in there. They actually look now at the senior management in these areas, and they often are women now. But there are other areas which are fairly excluded to women. But there's been a change in the workforce overall. Certainly, I'm looking now at Europe and the UK towards the service economy, which has meant that there have been more opportunities open for women. If we're looking at the 19th century, most people worked in heavy industry, as women were excluded from coal mining, and also some of the textile, heavy textile jobs, metallurgy, engineering and so on. And so some of the early trade unions just didn't organise women at all. They had no scope or intention of organising women. They just weren't part of the workforce. However, that's set to change with capitalism has revolutionised the workforce all the time, and you had new industries springing up at the end of the 19th century, food processing, for instance. And of course there were key strikes in these areas in the East End of London. Things about the Match Girl strike, the women went on strike, and the conditions working in this factory were absolutely atrocious. Some of them got decomposing jaws through working with phosphorus, and these women were organised into the trade union movement. By the middle of the 20th century you had again more light engineering. And of course, you had the growth of the service sector, offices, office employment. And so this has been the main area where women have been pulled into the workforce and organised. And you say, women are 80% of the membership of Unison now. In fact, because of the decline in manufacturing, women are actually quite a large proportion of the trade union movement. But because of this separation between women's work and men's work, you actually had a lot of almost hostility amongst some male workers, engineers, skilled engineers, towards women workers. They thought there should be a family wage, that a skilled man should be able to support his family, not so his wife shouldn't have to work. So the engineering union was actually hostile towards recruiting women, and right up until recent times, actually, they had a separate rate for women members. They paid a different colour card from all the others. He had skilled, semi-skilled and women, that's how the union itself was organised. So things have moved on quite a lot. Of course, in the 19th century, another major employer of women was domestic labour. In some ways, I'm afraid we've turned a full circle there. Some women, professional women, are actually employing other women to look after their children and homes now. So in some ways, we've turned a bit of a full circle. Of course, women preferred the freedom of working in the factory, gave them more independence. If you were a domestic servant, you actually had to live in the house, and your employer had full control over you. You weren't allowed out, that sort of thing. Really quite bad. So women organised themselves into the trade union movement, and you had the Women's Trade Union League, which was set up initially, not for a separate organisation, but to get women into the trade union movement and to work with the TUC. The TUC itself first came out in favour of equal pay in 1885, but as I say, the Equal Pay Act wasn't passed until 1970. The Equal Pay Act was passed, and a lot of employers actually used this act. There was delay; its implementation came. It took 5 years to be implemented. Employers actually tried to vary the jobs of women who were working in their factories, so that they could say, "Well, women can be paid a different rate because they're doing slightly different jobs." So, and that's where the demand for equal pay for equal value has come about. Now, this has actually had a lot of publicity over recent months, actually, because a lot of women working for local authorities have, they sort of care assistants have been paying, because care assistants, mainly women, you think refuse collectors, mainly men, and you think, therefore they're different jobs, and employers will traditionally pay the one more than the other. So if you look at a skill, doing a job evaluation, look at the skills involved, you can see that, the care assistants are being grossly underpaid. Now, the unions have been taking this cause up, job evaluation. But the employers have their own agenda as well. They've tried to get everybody, local authorities, get them onto a single spine, which is unfortunately has led to a lot of downgrading as well as pulling other people up. And some women have gone to these, or really they've been approached by lawyers who have actually made quite a lot of money out of taking up their case for, job evaluation and equal pay. And unfortunately, local authorities haven't given the money to actually compensate them for the back pay when they win their job evaluation case. And that has actually led to cuts in, wages for, for some of the existing workforce who may, some of them are women and some are men. This is not the way this legislation was intended to have worked. So this has been quite controversial. But throughout the 1970s, you had a growing number of women involved in the trade union movement. We had a Labour government in at that time, and it was Labour government who introduced the Equal Pay Act and also the Sex Discrimination Act of 1975. We had a strike of women in West London at Tricos for equal pay, which they won. We also had strikes of women, mainly women workers at Grumwicks, which was for trade union recognition. That was a plant in North London where the women, mainly women workers, mainly Asian women workers who'd never been involved in a trade union before. And in the late 70s, when trade union movement really took off and you know, got an expansion to 14 million, which is a lot higher than it is now, of the workforce in this country was organised, that women were actually quite a large part of that growth in the trade union movement. The situation with the Labour Party as well, again, women had been involved in politics for quite a long time. You know, they'd been involved in movements like the Chartists, the cooperative movement, and these movements fed into the development of the Labour Party. But again, you had, because the Labour Party was initially based on the trade union movement, which had a mainly male membership, it was actually very difficult to involve women at first. So you had a women's Labour League to involve women, and eventually that did actually amalgamate with the Labour Party, became the women's section of the Labour Party. Now, time is moving on here. I'd say that one of the issues that was raised quite a lot in the 1980s was the question of positive discrimination and in the States, affirmative action. This is something that's been discussed. Now, the thing about this, it was assumed that everybody started on a level playing field, and that you know, if you only get you know the same women onto short lists, if you get them as quotas, you could have women on short lists and they would actually get places reserved for them and so on. I think the problem is that discrimination against women actually goes quite deep in society, and even today that girls are not given the same aspirations maybe that boys are given at an early stage. So, you know, some jobs you just don't get women who are actually applying. We also had the issue of positive discrimination within the Labour movement itself in order to get more women active and representative on committees. But again, the problem was that women weren't coming forward because of the pressures of doing the job and, you know, keeping a home, keeping a home together, the double shift, so to speak. So you couldn't just have legislation allowing for quotas and you know, increasing the numbers of women in certain jobs and so on, because women actually needed the support to be able to continue working their career. In a situation where the workplace changes very quickly in terms of the IT developments there have been over the last 30 years, it's been very difficult for a woman to actually take a career break, to have a family and then come back, you know. So therefore, you need you know, far better childcare than we actually have to allow women to work full-time and to pursue their careers. So I think I'll leave that there at this point. Just to say that as Marxists, we see the emancipation of women is tied up with the emancipation of the working class as a whole, but recognising that there are special problems with the oppression of women that actually go deeper than the origins of capitalism itself. But nevertheless, recognising that many of the problems that are faced by working women are also faced by working men, such as low pay, the work-life balance, affordable housing, you know, coping with getting into work on London Transport, all these sorts of things actually represent the class as a whole, and therefore they are tied up with the need to change society. And just to say that, of course, you know, we're in a situation now, well, in this country, where women are 50%. In fact, the government's been very keen to get more women back into work, actually even to the point of cutting off their benefits, you know, if they're sort of like single parents. But having said that, if you look at the world situation as a whole, look at what's going on in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, where women can't even go out on the streets. And also, you know, in Eastern Europe, actually, where the overthrow of the old regime, whatever it, you know, whether we think of what it was like in Eastern Europe, certainly the reintroduction of capitalism in Eastern Europe has led to women losing a lot of their, you know, their earlier advantages, such as full employment, for instance. Women were actually losing their jobs. And also a lot of the support, the social services support was lost as well. And this has been, to the detriment in particular of women. In fact, you can see how in Eastern Europe, sadly, the prostitution trade is absolutely rife because these women, haven't got any other form of support. And that's why you're having women trafficked from places like the Ukraine, being trafficked all over Europe. An absolute disgrace, actually. But that's with the collapse of Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, but that's what's happened there. Also, that as I say, when capitalism goes into decline, women are the first to be shown the door, and this has happened in the 1930s, and it could happen again if we were actually faced with another recession, that there would be this drive to get back to the home. And of course, you get the emergence of reactionary ideas as well. We even saw it with the Tory Party, in the early 1990s with John Major and his Back to Basics campaign, the idea that, lots to restore family life. But that came to a sticky end after a lot of the Tory politicians were actually discredited. But just a warning to say that, the time we've lived through since 1997 may not be typical, and that, you can always got to beware for the emergence of really reactionary ideas in relation to women. I mean, in the States, they've been calling for the disbandment of some of the affirmative action programs. Now, I mean, having said something about the limitations of that, nevertheless, the calls for these then to be disbanded is a completely reactionary position, that it's trying to enforce the position of women as in the home and out of the workforce. So, the struggle for the emancipation of women is a political struggle, and it is tied up with changing society along socialist lines, and I'll leave that there.